It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome to Money for Lunch, everybody. It's it's always great to start the day off with you guys. I appreciate you very much. And the quote of the day is by Eric Jerome Dickey. Eric Jerome Dickey, it's impossible to explain creativity. It's like asking a bird, how do you fly? You just do. It's impossible to explain creativity. It's just like asking a bird, how do you fly? Man, you just do it. All right. Having said that, my guest today is Danny Ram. Danny Ram is a writer, producer with credits including Criminal Minds, Booger Bottom USA, and one of my favorite shows that I just discovered recently, Hollywood Weapons. Danny Ram, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks very much, Bert. Good to be here.
All right. So, you know, you and I met, I guess, a few weeks back. You guys were gracious enough to invite me on Criminal Minds set there. That was a lot of fun. And then you were talking about this show called Hollywood Weapons, and which I thoroughly enjoy. I think it's really well done. It's a lot. It's part entertainment, part science. It's a really, really good show. So why don't you tell everybody what is Hollywood Weapons?
Well, thanks. I mean, first of all, it was a pleasure. You know, you have a wonderful family. It was a pleasure to have you guys out there. And I think you guys came out on a day we were on location. So that was even a funner day to do that. But Hollywood Weapons is sort of a show, I guess, sort of inspired by like a Mythbusters type show. But it's more specific than that. In other words, what we do is we take a specific scene from a TV show or a movie where a weapon is used in some way that seems unbelievable when you see it. And I'll give you an example of that in a minute. And then we test that to see, does it really work that way? So, for example, like one of the episodes we tested was Jaws. You know, if you shoot a scuba tank in a shark's mouth, will it explode? Now, I know that sort of a test has been done before, but what we do is we actually try to replicate the entire scene. So we took Terry Shepard, who is our host, and we couldn't do it in the water because it's not really environmentally friendly to do something like this in the water. So we went to a range out in Arizona. We built a ship's mast on an angle, just like Roy Scheider was on when he shot the shark. Gave him the same exact weapon, an M1 Garand. And then what we did is we had a fiberglass shark made almost to, I mean, the biggest one we could make was about, I think it was about 18 feet, which is a little smaller than Jaws was, but that's the biggest fiberglass shark we could get made, which I got to tell you is the funniest thing when you see that rolling down the street on a trailer. That turns your heads, I'll tell you right now. But we stuck a pressurized tank in the mouth of this thing and had it on a motorized robot, basically, that was coming at Terry at the same speed, at the same distance as the scene in the movie. So Terry had two challenges. The first challenge was, can you even hit this thing coming at you, bouncing around, moving? Because you're talking about a target that's about the size of a pie pan. It's very small. You're in an awkward position. You're shooting a heavy, an M1 Garand is a very heavy rifle, World War II heavy rifle. So there's a lot of things in play here. Terry is a 23-year Green Beret Army veteran. So he did hit it. He did hit the tank. And then the second part of the test is, would it actually explode? Which I won't ruin if people want to see the episode, because we're on Netflix. If people want to tune in, the first two seasons are on Netflix right now.
Yeah,
so it's a lot of fun. I mean, we just test stuff for movies. We all sit around and we see a movie like Die Hard or James Bond, and we go, wait a minute, can you really do that? And then we put it to the test.
Yeah, no, I love it. I when you told me about it, you know, I was intrigued simply because of the there is that science application of it. You know, I mean, it's cool to see the whole thing. So if you guys have not seen this show, it is available on Netflix, and it's also available on the Outdoors channel, correct?
Yes, it's Outdoor Channel is where it originated, and then the first two seasons aired there. An Outdoor Channel is like an outdoor lifestyle channel. It's hunting, camping, fishing, all that kind of stuff. And I already had another show on Outdoor Channel for almost, I think we just finished our eighth season of that. It's called Gun Stories. And Joe Montaigne is actually the host of that. And it's a sort of a documentary style program. It's basically the history of firearms. So every episode we take a particular firearm and we try to tell the history of that firearm in about 30 minutes from its inception and who invented it and why and how it was used and if it's still used today and how. So I had had a lot of I had a track record with Outdoor Channel, and they came to me. Tim Kremen, who's the VP of original programming, came to me and he said, you know, we're looking to create some kind of a show that still will speak to our core audience, which is outdoors people, outdoorman type people, but it also has a higher entertainment value. And so Tim and I sort of came up with this idea of this sort of twist on testing things like that. And that's when it was born. And so I started writing them. The first episode we did was actually a test of a Criminal Minds episode where one of the heroes, Thomas Gibson, has to dive underwater, and he shoots his Glock underwater at the windshield of a bad guy, and ultimately it shoots through the windshield and kills the bad guy. And I thought, well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know a little bit about firearms, but I didn't think a Glock would even fire underwater, let alone break a windshield and shoot through it. So that was our first episode, and we tested that in a tank with a windshield with a real Glock, and it was really a fascinating. And this is the thing that I love about our show is we never know what's going to happen. Like, we don't know the end result. We're always surprised when we do a test. We're working on season three right now, and we've done some tests that we could not believe we were able to accomplish. It was really, it's been a lot of fun so far.
And you know what's extraordinary about Hollywood Weapons is that, first of all, you've had some great guest stars, Tom Selleck and some other, Gary Sinise and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But you guys go, you mentioned building this fiberglass shark, and you guys really put stuff to the test because you spare no expense. I mean, there are some shows where you guys have spent, I don't know, what a ballistic torso with bones and blood and guts cost, but it's not cheap.
No, it's not cheap at all. No, we try. I mean, we you're right. I mean, but we sort of feel like if you don't do it, either do it all the way or you don't do it at all, you know?
Right.
Because anybody can just shoot a rifle at a scuba tank. But if you're going to try to replicate that scene, then you got to have a shark. And how do you have a shark? Can't use a real shark. Yeah. I mean, and that shark, I think that shark costs something like $8,000 or $9,000. Just to try to blow up. I mean, we don't skimp if we can.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. I think that, you know, and here's the other thing that's great about Hollywood Weapons is that, first of all, it has to do with kind of almost like the behind the scenes, how things work, right? And so for a nerd like me, I'm one of those guys who will only buy a DVD that has the director's cut or the, you know, the stuff in the background,
right?
Because that to me is fascinating. Then get to visit ISS, which is the Independent Studio Services. I think the largest prop house in the world. It's certainly the biggest one in the U.S., I think. And so you get to see some of that. You get to blow stuff up and shoot guns. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that.
No, it doesn't. And ISS plays a very important role in that. Larry Zanoff, who is the co-host of the show, is the firearms expert for us. So You know, you mentioned the entertainment part of the show. I mean, it's funny because people have asked me like, well, what's your favorite episode? And it's like having kids, you know, the last one is my favorite one. But if you said, which is your least favorite, I would almost say it's the pilot, because when we did the pilot, it was very straightforward. I mean, there wasn't a lot of humor. There wasn't a lot of comedy. It was just kind of a straightforward, can you do this? And we tested it. And Terry Shepard is a very funny individual. And when he got together with Larry Zanoff, because Larry is our weapons expert and ISS is part of our program, Larry is very straightforward. I don't want to say he's dry, but he's the adult in the room. I like to say that Terry's like the 15-year-old boy saying, can we do this? Can we do this? And Larry is like the dad going, yes, okay, but calm down. We're going to do it safely. Let me get my belt on and we'll go do this. You know, that's Larry's sort of role. And so what happened is during the pilot, I noticed in between takes, I noticed this sort of banter going on where Larry would roll his eyes and Terry would say something like, well, what if we did this? And Larry would be like, oh my God, Terry, calm down. We'll do it later, later. And I thought, this has got to be part of the show. So starting with the second episode, which was our Jaws test episode, I decided that what we wanted to do to really separate this show from anything else like it, I said, we gotta make it fun and funny. And so Terry, it turned into this thing where now Terry took on the persona of characters from the movie that we're testing. So in Jaws, it opens up as him. He's pretending to be Roy Scheider on the beach. As we're actually in Malibu, but he's pretending to be Roy Scheider on the beach of Martha's Vineyard, and he spots a shark in the water, and he sticks the sign in the sand, beware of sharks. You know, it just starts that way. And then later on in the episode, he's pretending to be Quint. And as you've seen, he's pretended to be Clint Eastwood from Good, Bad, and the Ugly. He's pretended to be, Given
Bond.
From Justified, James Bond. I mean, you name it. And it has just turned into this whole other kind of fun show. And what I'm really surprised about, most surprised about, is Terry and Larry have done a few appearances at some outdoor events in Texas and different places. And what we're all so surprised at is how popular the show is with kids. Kids love this show. And I think it's because Terry is a big kid at heart. But also, we always have a segment within each episode called Terry's Knucklehead Science, where he named that himself. And that's the segment where once Terry has explained what he wants to test, he goes into, as much as possible, the science behind why we think it won't or will work. And then of course we test it. And so I think, we get lots and lots of emails from people. We've gotten thousands of emails since it's been on Netflix of people saying, man, my kids and I watch the show. We love it. We can't wait for more episodes. We think Terry and Larry are hilarious and we love the science aspect. It's just, I don't know. It just has become something so much more than I think any of us ever really expected. And we never expected it to get onto Netflix and that has just been icing on the cake, because it was the number one show on Outdoor Channel, and I guess Netflix caught wind of it and said we gotta put this on. And since then, I mean, Terry was in Japan not long ago and got recognized in the airports like, hey, you're the guy from Hollywood Weapons, you know. And I thought, wow, yeah, exactly. We're reaching out now. It's pretty. I mean, we've gotten emails from Australia, New Zealand, England. It's just for me, it's incredibly gratifying. I can't tell you how grateful I am that the show has been so well received.
All right, so let's talk about this. First of all, walk me through. You met with this guy from the Outdoor Channel, and you said, hey, let's put something together. And how did you create, think of, you know, Hollywood Weapons? What was the... You know, I don't know if you can remember, but, you know, how was that? How did you come up with Hollywood?
Yeah. Well, it was Tim Kremen and I were having dinner. We were actually having dinner with Larry Zanoff at the time, because Larry has been a consultant on the other show, Gun Stories, since the beginning as well. So we were all having dinner, and Tim was telling me, you know, we got to come up with a show that speaks to our core audience. It still has that sort of outdoor lifestyle aspect to it, but also is something that will attract a broader audience, something that is a little outside the box for us. So we started just spitballing ideas, as you do, you know, and I don't remember who said it first or how it came up, but we started talking about, well, what if we tested things from movies and TV shows? And it was like, well, what do you mean? And it was like, well, if we took a specific scene, and then we started coming up with ideas, well, what about Jaws? Remember when he shoots the scuba tank? Well, yeah, but, you know, somebody said, yeah, but that's been done before. And I said, yeah, but what if we did it where we try to really do the whole scene where Terry, you know, we didn't have Terry at the point. So the host is leaning on the mast of a ship, and he's actually trying to shoot at a moving target. And, wow, that took it to a whole other level, you know. We did a test, Clint Eastwood movie, Good, Bad, and the Ugly, when Eli Wallach gets arrested. Well, actually, the way the scheme in the movie is that Clint Eastwood, Eli Wallach is a wanted man, so Clint Eastwood keeps taking him and turning him in, collecting the reward, and then breaking him out at the last minute, and then they go to the next town and do the same scam. And the way he does it is every time Eli Wallach is getting ready to be hung, Clint Eastwood shoots the rope, breaking the rope, and and then Eli Wallach is free. Well, he does it three different times in the movie, and each time it's different. Once he's from an elevated position up in a barn, another time he's on a horse, and the last time he's on a horse, but from a really long distance. So I said, well, what if we did all three tests from all three positions on a live horse? I mean, you know, you start escalating it like that, not just can you break a rope with a bullet, but can you even make that shot? How hard is that shot? So that's kind of the beginning of it. And then Tim and I went back to my office in Burbank, and I think, like, I feel like I hear these stories, you know, when I wrote Let It Be in 3 minutes, you know, Paul McCartney said. And it was kind of like that. I mean, he and I schemed out every act of the show. I mean, we had the whole thing figured out in about 20 to 30 minutes. And we kind of looked at it, looked at each other, and I said, are we done? Is this it? Is this the show? And he goes, I think it is. And that was it. And I still use today, I write every episode. I've written almost 30 episodes now, and I still use that blueprint for each episode when I write it.
Wow, that is cool. But I think, you know, you hear about, you know, things like you said, Paul McCartney or even Stallone, who wrote Rocky, I think, in a 24-hour nonstop frenzy writing period or whatever, something like that. And I think that comes into, you know, it happens when you're listening or, you know, to your creativity, because I think that, you know, and give you your thoughts on this. There's a lot of people out there who might get inspiration, but instead of going with the flow and seeing where that inspiration goes, they stop. Well, you know, who am I to think like that? And this is dumb. If this was really a good idea, somebody else already would have thought about it, and it kills it. And I think what happens is that you, and I think Terry, you said, we're in that flow, and you went with it, and you banged it out. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, what you said is true. I think artists are their own worst critics, and you do tend to second guess yourself a lot. You do tend to think, is this right? Is this wrong? You know, are people going to like this or whatever? And you know, we did the pilot, and then, like I said, the pilot is very unlike the rest of the episodes, and Outdoor Channel spent the money to have it tested with test audiences, and it tested really, really high. And so they were very excited about it, and they funded a first season. But I had seen this chemistry between Larry and Terry, and I thought, man, this, I can't ignore that. I can't ignore what I see here, because it's funny. And I think that's what this show – that's what makes this show next level, is making it also funny, not just science and wow, yes, Larry, the bullet did pierce the armor, pierced ground. You know, like, no, there's got to be some fun to it, you know. And so we're dealing with Hollywood. We're dealing with TV shows and movies, and how is that not fun, you know?
Yeah.
And I had written – so I had written the Jaws episode, and then I had written the Good, Bad, and the Ugly episode that both had a lot of humor in it. And I remember Tim Kremen, who, like I said, he's the guy that I created the show with,
Tim,
the VP of original programming. And he read those two scripts, and I'll never forget getting a call. Actually, he came in town. We were getting ready to shoot the second episode, and he came in town with the crew, and he said, he pulled me aside, and he said, "I got to tell you, these next two episodes, they're very different from the pilot." I said, I know, but trust me, it's going to be great." And he goes, "I got to tell you, I'm a little nervous about this. I'm a little nervous about it being so different from what our pilot was, since our pilot tested so well. I'm concerned that we're straying from the formula too much." And I said, "I know, but just, I just feel like it's going to work. It just, you know." So, and also luckily Terry Shepard, the host, he sided with me, and he said, "Tim, this is funny stuff, man. We got to do this. This is what this show needs." And to Tim's credit, he let us do it. And he said, "Okay, I'm going to let you go for this. We all might get fired." And I remember saying to Tim, but what happened was, I said to Tim, I go, "Tim, I don't know what audiences want. I don't think anybody really knows what an audience is going to respond to or what they're going to want. All I can tell you is I would watch this show. And if I would watch this show, then this is the show I want to write." And we all felt that way. Tim was like, "Well, I would watch this." And Terry was like, "I would watch this." So we felt like if we would watch it, that's the most important thing. And I said, "Look, if we do the first season," because nothing aired until all 8 episodes of the first season were completed. And I said, "Look, Tim, if the whole thing fails, I'm okay with that. But if I don't do it the way I feel like it should go, and then it fails, I'm only going to do this other way, the way I wanted to do it, it would have been great. You know, I'm okay right. with failure. If I do what I think I'm supposed to do, you know, that failure I'm fine with. I just chalk that up to, well, you know, everybody makes a mistake. Everybody fails once in a while. But when I fail because I listen to that voice, whatever it is, if it's an external or an internal voice telling me, no, don't do that. That's too far. You're pushing it too far. Or that's not funny. Or that's not." And I fail. Then that upsets me. That's what gets me.
Yeah. So, and I agree with you. I hope everybody listens, gets a hold of that, because it's so important for us to listen to our instinct, our gut, whatever you want to call it. And I think a lot of us, sometimes we shut down that part of our intelligence. And then it's like anything else. If you don't use it, after a while, you lose it. But let's talk about this. Let's talk about this thing called Booger Bottom USA. What is Booger Bottom USA? Just
well, you know, the thing that happens, you know, is when you start to have a little bit of success in something, then everybody says, "Oh, do show too," you know. Michael Waddell has a show on Outdoor Channel called The Bone Collector. It's a hunting show. And he mostly hunts within the United States. He hunts, you know, deer and moose and elk and things like that within the U.S. Mostly. And he's been on the air on Outdoor Channel for, I don't know, probably 8 years now, I think, maybe longer. And it's their most popular hunting show that they have. And Michael is a very funny, charming, charismatic individual from southern Georgia. About 100 miles south of Atlanta is Pine Mountain, Georgia, and then Hamilton, Georgia. And then below that, you have Warm Springs. And Warm Springs is where President Roosevelt had his little White House. Franklin Roosevelt had where he would go to a retreat. And kind of in between all that is a community called Booger Bottom, and there was a swamp there that they call Booger Bottom that's kind of dried up now. But back in the Prohibition, there was a lot of bootlegging and stuff that went on back there. And so that's where Michael was from and his family is from. I mean, generations of the. So long story short, you know, again, Michael said, "You know, my life is so crazy. I just bought a pecan farm and this and that. And, you know, it's almost like a reality show." We thought, "Wow, reality show? Interesting." So we kind of went back and forth and talked about it for almost 2 years and finally sort of figured out this is something we're not, you know. I mean, that's the thing for me creatively. Whenever something just doesn't go away in my I have to do something on it. And that doesn't, and it never means that it's always going to equal something in the end. I mean, I've got lots of scripts that equal nothing right now, but if I have an idea and I just can't get it out of my mind, the only way I can get out of my mind is sit down and go through the process and write it out. And then if nobody wants it, I sit on the shelf and I think, okay, well, at least it's out of my head now, you know. But I couldn't get this thing with Michael out of my mind, and I kept talking to Tim about it and Michael about it. Finally, we decided, let's do this. And we're in the midst of filming the first season right now, and it's basically a behind-the-scenes look at Michael's life. I didn't even get out to hunt. He's got 5 kids. He's got a bunch of funny and crazy relatives and friends, and he's got like a 300-acre pecan farm that tries to make. And I spent a few days down there. Tim and I both went down there for a few days. Tell us stories about his family and about his life and about things that have happened. And I'm making notes as fast as I can. Everything that's happening to him is so ridiculous. And I said, gee, there's a lot here, you know. And so what we have done is we sort of take everything that is true that has really happened to him, and we've in some way tried to either recreate it or get it to kind of happen again so we can capture it on film. And I got to say, it's pretty dang funny. I mean, it's really, really happy so far. I've seen the first, I think we're getting ready to film episode 6, and I've seen the first 3, and I'm very happy with it. It's very different from Hollywood. It's more like, I mean, I hate to compare it to Duck Dynasty, but I think that's what everybody kind of knows. Some Southern guys that have a business and, you know, some goofy relatives and stuff. But, and I guess that's what it's kind of most like, but these are very authentic people. I think that's what was drawn to me. Not to say that a lot of reality shows, those people are not those Joe. I know that.
Right.
But when I met Michael and his family and his cousins and his father, these people are these people. They really are authentic people. And that's what really got me excited about it, because I thought, you can't fake that. You know, the way these people are, you can't fake this. And all I have to do is say, all right, remember that time when your cousin came to the door at 3 o'clock in the morning and knocked on the door, that story you told? Yeah, we're gonna do that again and play it out like that. And it's just amazing what happened. It's just very funny.
Well, and so, you know, the thing with Duck Dynasty is, of course, you know, there's all the merchandise and products. So, you know, Boomer Bottom, I think, is just as alliterative as Duck Dynasty. So maybe you'll have another Duck Dynasty, Boomer Bottom Dynasty on your hand? Boomer Bottom Bonanza?
Michael, I mean, he doesn't make anything. Like, he doesn't make duck calls. It's really just slice of life. It's just,
yeah.
I think for most people, you know, we were talking about this, and I said, and I'm from the Midwest. I mean, I'm from Kansas City, Missouri, so I instantly related to a lot of these people. Like, oh, I got a cousin like that. I got an uncle like that. I got, you know, for me, it was like going home. But I've lived in LA since, you know, 1984. When you live in a big urban city like LA or New York or Chicago or any of those kind of places, a peek into that lifestyle in the South is really fascinating, because the way people live, the way they talk, the things that they do for fun, the hobbies they have. I mean, it's just a completely different way of life. It's just so what they find enjoyment in is typically so simple. And for a guy who's so used to living in the fast life of LA, when I go down there and everything kind of slows down, my wife and I make the joke, like, ain't nobody in a hurry down here, so don't try to get anything done fast. Okay. But after a day or two, you start to get relaxed and you start to realize there's no rush. Hey, relax. Look at the trees. It's beautiful. And it's a gorgeous part of the country to be in. So it's just, I really enjoy it down there. I have a really good time. And I think the show will be great, and it's going to come. It's going to air initially on Outdoor Channel in the first quarter of next season. And Hollywood Weapons, I think they both come on around the same time. I know Hollywood Weapons is scheduled. The new season is scheduled to come out January 5th. And then I think in the March, I think it goes on to Netflix. And then Booger Bottom will air around the same time on Outdoor Channel. Then I think around March, it's going to go to Discovery. So it'll have a whole new audience there, hopefully.
Man, that's cool. All right, so let's talk about this. You know, let's say that somebody's listening to us and they're going, man, you know, Danny, I have some ideas, or I've shot a pilot, or I have a script, or I have this premise to, you know, for a show. Talk about what it takes to get a show, you know, from idea to selling it to a network like Outdoor Channel to, you know, to getting a show funded. So talk about that. What's the process?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to lie. It's really hard. It's I like to say it's almost like winning the lottery. You know, I mean, I bought a lot of tickets because I've been doing this a long time, but it's not easy. It really is not. It is not an easy process, but I will say there's more outlets these days with the internet than there has ever been. I mean, if you think back even just 20 years ago, if you had an idea for a show, and even just the equipment that it would cost, rent, to try to make a teaser or a sample of that show, you needed a lot of money. Well, nowadays,
right,
people even do stuff on their iPhones. I mean, it's gotten to be – the technology has advanced so much that you can really do quality stuff on equipment that's not very expensive. So in that aspect, it's gotten a little easier. And you can always – and I tell people this because I get asked this question, you know, how can I get people – you know, what if I have a good idea for a show? All right, do you have friends? Yeah, I have friends. Great. Get your friends together. Make a teaser, make a 3-minute example of your show and put it online, put it on the internet, try to get it out there, get people to see it. There's outlets, there's all kinds of like film festivals and things like that these days, sort of cater to shorts and independent things and internet-based films and TV shows that you can get your material seen. And hopefully somebody will see it and say, hey, man, that's great. Because it's in the end, it's all about the product. It's all about the material. It's about the writing. It's about the production, and it's about the characters. We just did an episode on Hollywood about Breaking Bad, which I think is probably in the top 5 television shows of all time for me as far as quality. Because, and I kind of, when I was writing our episode, And Terry always, at the end of the episode, Terry Shepard, he always kind of does a close. He recaps the tests and talks about whatever movie or TV show we're testing. And one of the things I had him say was, so many shows or movies are about the special effects, you know, but Breaking Bad is all about the characters, and that's what makes it a great show. And that's the truth. And when you have fascinating characters, it doesn't really matter what they're doing. Joe Montaigne, who I've been in sort of business partners with now for about 17 years, he likes to say, you know, he's from the theater, so he started on Broadway. That's where he really kind of became famous, when he won the Tony on Broadway for Glengarry Glen Ross. And he said, you know, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage. And I think that's the truth. And he'll tell you, right, also, he says, you know, what if I said to you, I have a great idea for a TV show. It's about a guy who drives a bus, and he lives with his wife in this apartment, and above him is a guy who works in the sewer with his wife. What do you think? And he's talking about the Honeymooners, you know.
Right.
And the premise is horrible, but the characters are fantastic, you know. And so if you can develop really strong characters and even a good premise, then you've got something. And if you think about all your favorite TV shows, maybe it's Seinfeld, maybe it's Mad About You, maybe it's CSI, whatever it is. And even Criminal Minds, you know, it's funny. I see this all the time with Criminal Minds fans. When you say, well, what do you like about Criminal Minds? They hardly ever say, oh, I love the crimes that you investigate. What do they say? Oh, I love the Derek Morgan and how he treats Penelope. Or I love David Rossi. He's kind of like everybody's dad. You know, like they always refer to something personal about the characters, not the premise of the show. And it's like, it just reinforces what Joe says and what I think is really true, is that it's really about the characters. That's what we invest in. You know, when we watch a TV show, we invest in the characters and, oh my God, is that guy going to tell his wife that, you know, that he cheated on her? Holy moly. You know, that's what we get invested in. We don't get invested in, oh, that guy did it. I'm sure he did. He's the criminal. Let's catch him. Let's take him to jail. That's it. You know. So,
and that's what you
my,
said about.
Go ahead.
I was
just
going
to say, so my advice always to writers is develop your characters first. Really think about who they are. Base them on real people. Base them on your relatives. Base them on your friends. Base them on people that you know. And then put them in a situation that's interesting. And then you got something.
Yeah, because it never is about the special effects. The special effects is the dressing on top or whatever. It definitely adds to the story, but it is not the story, because nobody cares about, for example, yes, the lightsaber in Star Wars is an iconic symbol, but we care about how Luke goes from being a, you know, farm boy to a hero in the Alliance, right? And we care
exactly
about, you know, how Darth Vader transforms from being Darth Vader to saving Luke from being killed. So whether it's Criminal Minds, whether it's Hollywood Weapons, even, it is about the people who are telling the story. And I totally agree with you. You know, you can tell, okay, and this is no, I'm not by any means trying to slight Mr. Sanoff, but you can tell that it's not his core strength to be, you know, for lack of better terms, the straight guy to Terry's funny guy, right? But
right,
the chemistry is real. It is fun to watch these two guys butt head. It's fun to have Larry tell, Larry kind of make fun of Terry, right? I mean, he and stuff like that. And it is fun to watch that interaction. And I think that that interaction adds a layer to the whole episode, because when you look at Mythbusters, for example, yes, some of their experiments were absolutely cool and fun, but, it was the interaction of the people. I can't remember the characters now, but you had the two main guys, and sometimes they butted heads, and sometimes they had fun together, and sometimes they were ripping on each other. But that added a certain level, and it made you want to watch it. And it also, back to what you were saying, it helps you identify with that person or their cousin or their uncle. And it's really it's what all humans, so why we tell stories, because we tell a story and we put ourselves in that story. We identify with the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Right. Well, I think your analogy of Star Wars is perfect, because if you break Star Wars, the original Star Wars movie, if you break it down really simple, it's basically a story of a dysfunctional family. It's about a father who left his family when the wife had twins. The twins got separated at birth. They don't even know each other. You know, the one kid has been shuffled off to some other family members to raise. You know, now they're all trying to, like, find each other and get back together. And dad's a jerk, and, you know, but he wants me to come to the dark side with him. I mean, it's just one big dysfunctional family, really. And I think your point about Larry, I mean, that's why Larry, because Larry is so of Terry that it just works. It does. I mean, they just, some of the most funny moments, I think, is when Larry says nothing and just stares at Terry as he's saying something very ridiculous, or doing something very ridiculous. Tell Larry is thinking to himself, why am I doing this show? What Why have I subjected myself to this torture? To be standing out here, it's 100 degrees, I'm out here in rifle range, with this crazy person who's dressed up like, you know, James Bond.
Oh, we had a little drop call, which happens occasionally here on the show. And let's see if we can get Danny Ram back on the show. We had a little technical glitch there, so let's see if we can make it happen, man. Let's see. Oh, there we are. There we are.
But
and you're back.
But, sorry about that.
That's all right. Hey, it's live. It happened.
Yeah. But anyway, I mean, I just love their chemistry. Larry and Terry's chemistry is awesome. I think they're really fun together. And we've added some new characters. I mean, in season two, we added a friend of our family, a guy named Pompeo Cepeda. Pompeo, he has no acting skills whatsoever. And we had used him in the first season in The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. We needed a Hispanic bartender in the old Mexico town set that we used. And my wife, her aunt had a friend, this guy, a really fun guy named Pompeo. And I said, gee, do you think Pompeo would, you know, just for a day come out, and he has one line. He just has to say, you know, now it's time for Terry's Knucklehead Science or whatever it was. Oh, she says, I don't know. Why don't you give him a call? So I called Pompeo. And he said, oh, I don't have any acting experience. I said, you don't need it. It's just TV. Come on, don't worry about it. So he came out, and he was really funny, you know. I mean, everybody liked him, and he's a sweet man. So then in the beginning of the second season, in the first season, if you notice, we really, every episode, it was like Terry was kind of tricking Larry into helping him or berating him into helping him. And I said, you know, we can't do this forever. It's got to get to a point where Larry's a little more willing. So in the second season, I said, but Terry needs somebody, a foil. He needs somebody that can be like his sidekick that he can always be goofing on or goofing with. And so I asked Pompeo. Everybody loved him. And I asked Tim and everybody else, John Carter, our director. I said, what do you think about bringing Pompeo in as like kind of a semi-regular, you know? Oh, that's a great idea. So we brought him in on season two, and he's in, I don't know, maybe half of the episodes. And he was just so fun and so funny that now in the third season, he's like a regular. He's in almost every episode now. And so he's part of it now. A guy named Andre Ellingson and Tom Seymour, special effects experts. Actually, they both work on Criminal Minds full time, and then on their part time or when the show's on hiatus, they work on our show. So when we want to do something really big, like an explosion or some sort of thing like that, you know, safety is like our number one thing. So we always bring in somebody who knows what they're doing. And we did an episode last season, I think it was, where we did a bunch of things from Westerns. There's all this stuff that we see in Westerns, like guy shoots a guy's hat and it flies off. Like, does that really happen when you shoot a cowboy hat, or does a bullet go right through it, you know?
Right.
Or the guy who's got the leg, the shackles on his legs. The guy takes his pistol or his rifle and shoots the irons. Well, one of the things that we wanted to test was, what happens if you shoot a stick of dynamite? Will it really explode, you know? Of course, when I told the network that, Outdoor Channel, I said, well, they said, how are you going to simulate that? I said, well, we're not going to simulate it. You're going to really shoot a stick of dynamite? Well, yeah. They freaked out. Oh, no, you can't do that. It's too dangerous. So I found an explosives manufacturer, an expert. His name was Jesse. I can't remember his last name. But he lives up in San Francisco. He came down and created dynamite for us there at gun range, made three sticks, I think it was, and we shot the sticks of dynamite. But we always bring in somebody who really knows what they're doing. We're not going to, you know, sort of half-ass anything when it comes to this. The last thing in the world anybody wants is we take every precaution possible. So Andre and Tommy are big bang kind of experts. Larry obviously is our expert when it comes to firearms. And then if something outside that, then we bring in another expert.
Yeah, you know, and this is what's interesting too. Back to Pompeo is this will be interesting to see how you know how this may impact his life, because you guys needed somebody who you needed for, you know, one line, and because this guy was you know, everybody liked him, and he did, you know, he did that one line well and all this other stuff. Bottom line, he was brought back over and over again. And, you know, right now listening, there's a bunch of actors going, flip, I, you know, I would have loved to have that. But sometimes, you know, you can't do an audition for that one line. You have to grab somebody that you kind of know and say, okay, look, we have this one line, because, you know, you don't expect it to go anyplace, right? But, you know, we see the same thing with, Jimmy Kimmel Live. I can't remember the gentleman that almost like Pompeo, right? He's a Hispanic gentleman who basically started doing one line, and now he's in almost every episode.
It happens. I mean, you just, you know, it's all about personality. I mean, Pompeo has a big personality, and he's got a very expressive face and eyes, and when he got up, he takes direction well, which a lot of actors don't. And you know, John, our director, would say, okay, Pompeo, try this, you know, do, you know, roll your eyes at this point or whatever. And when he does it, it's like, oh my God, that's so funny. And he did exactly what we asked him to do. So it just, you know, I mean, the guy was a travel agent. That's what he was doing for a living. When we hired him, and he has had some life change. I think he's, you know, he's getting fan mail now, which is very exciting. And he just, you know, he never dreamed in a million years that something like this would happen. But I'll tell you, you know, it's funny how things work. We were just talking about this over the last shoot, because we just finished two episodes in the last couple of weeks. But so oftentimes on this show, and on any show I've worked on, you know, you get so focused on, I want this certain thing to happen, or I want to cast this certain person, and that falls through, and then you think, well, what are we going to do? Well, let's do this instead. And it almost always, without fail, turns out that the thing that you do instead is better than what you imagined the first thing would be.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the way it was with Pompeo. I mean, we had a couple of people in mind, a couple of actual actors, the Hispanic actors that are friends of mine, that one guy wasn't available, the other guy couldn't get a hold of. And it was like I was getting a little desperate, and I thought, well, God, it's just one line. We'll just get Pompeo. I mean, he can do one line. It'll be fine, you know. And look what it's turned into, you know.
Yeah, I love it. And people love stories like that. All right, listen, we're almost out of time here. I want to ask you this, because you live in the world of rejection. How do you deal with rejection? Because you mentioned you've had a lot of, quote, failures. I call them rejections, whatever you want to call them. But you're submitting ideas, and people are saying yes, no, yes, no, 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 yes, maybe, kind of. So how do you deal with that?
You know, I think it's like the only thing I can equal it to is people who play guitar. When you first start playing guitar, man, your fingertips get very, very tender and sore, and then you start to build up a callus, and then pretty soon it doesn't bother you anymore. And I think that's what it is, because I mean, I've been on pitch meetings where I walk out of there thinking they're going to buy this. I'm ready to go out and celebrate. Let's pop the champagne. Nope. They're not, you know. I've even had financing. I had a script once where I had, for a film, I had the financing in place. Okay, we're going. I got the money. Let's go. And then it didn't happen. You know, I mean, it's hard. I'm not going to lie. It's very hard, but if you just got to persist, and you just got to try to take each failure or each disappointment and learn from it, and think about, all right, is there something because half the time it's not you. Most of the time, actually, it's not even you. You know, Joe and I actually had a sitcom that we were pitching, and we had gone to, and we're with ICM. And they loved it. They were so excited about this sitcom, and we had pitched. We were gonna pitch it everywhere, and we thought there was gonna be like, I mean, our agent was like, there's going to be a bidding war for this thing. I was so excited about this. And we went to, and it was basically about the White House. It was before we even knew Trump was going to get in. In my story, it was a woman president because I figured Hillary Clinton was going to win. And it was a comedy. It was a sitcom. And everybody loved it. Everyone thought it was funny. And we went out and started pitching it, and we pitched it to several places, and nobody wanted it. And the reason nobody wanted it is because Jenna Elfman had just done a show a few years ago at the time about the White House, and it had bombed so badly that everybody was like, oh, no, the White House is taboo. We're not going to do any sitcoms about the White House, which I think is silly because it's not even the same show. Like, I don't get that whole – I remember when there was that movie Cutthroat Island that Gina Davis did, and it was such a bomb, and everybody said, well, that's it. There's never going to be another pirate movie. Pirate movies, that genre is dead. And then Johnny Depp came along, and, you know, all of a sudden everybody's making Pirates of the Caribbean. Not, you know, there's like 9 sequels now. So I don't buy into that whole genre thing, but that's what happened. So, well, I guess we'll just wait a little while and maybe try it again.
Yeah, and you know what? Look, Jenna Elfman, I like her.
I do too.
But you mentioned personalities, and sometimes, you know, for example, Cutthroat Island to me, I like, what was her name? Gina Davis, is that right?
Yeah. Gina Davis.
Okay, so I like Gina Davis. I liked her. I think she's a great action hero type. She did that other action hero movie. But what was her act? The co-actor, whatever his name was, Matthew Bodine. Co-star.
Matthew Bodine. Yeah.
I didn't think it was a good part for him. I think that he was miscast in that movie, and that's one of the reasons that movie didn't do so well. Now, that's just my opinion. I don't have the expertise that you have, but, you know, you look at Back to the Future. Originally, Back to the Future had, what's his name, Stoltz as the Marty McFly character. And, you know, they had filmed, like, I don't know, hours and hours, and finally Steven Spielberg and the other guy said, you know what, this guy isn't as funny. Let's just cut our losses, and they finally worked the deal out with Michael J. Fox, and it's a completely different movie, you know? Go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, and how brave is that? How brave is that to stop production? I mean, because that's not a cheap thing. You've already spent maybe millions of dollars, and Eric Stoltz got paid whatever his contract for doing that part, he still got paid that money.
Right.
That takes a lot of guts to stop and start over like that. I mean, most people would just say, well, let's just do it and get it done and cross our fingers and hope for the best. I guess that's why Spielberg is Spielberg, because he's smart enough to know, like, no, this is not right. We got to do it again, you know?
Yeah, and I think you're right. First of all, that does take guts, and I think that if Steven Spielberg wouldn't have had the guts to say, hey, this is not working, the chemistry's not there, it would have been a different movie, and maybe, you know, who knows what would have happened. And so that's my point with, I think with Jenna Elfman, she was awesome in that one sitcom. In fact, speaking of Criminal Minds, it had, what's his name from Criminal Minds?
Oh, Thomas Gibson. Dharma and Greg,
Tom and Greg, and let me tell you, I thought the chemistry was good. It was a fun show, but
it was.
It's very different. It's very different to go from this ensemble cast to, hey, everything is riding on, you know, on one person, or in this case, Jenna Elfman. It's just like Seinfeld. You mentioned Seinfeld or Friends. You know, in fact, only one person from Friends went on to do extremely well, Jennifer Aniston, and that's because she didn't try to, for lack of better terms, recapture the Friends spirit, right? She didn't jump into another sitcom. she went off and she did the movies, and I think that was a great move for her. And then the actress that played Monica Geller, you know, I think she did some other things, and then she came back and did a sitcom, Cougar Town. And that, you know, again, was an ensemble cast. I thought it was pretty good. But, you know, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to go from a, you know, to go from one sitcom to another one and get the same chemistry. So it's interesting that they wouldn't give you guys a chance.
Success in general in Hollywood is extremely rare. I mean, Criminal Minds just finished their 300th episode not long ago. And
that's incredible.
That is, I mean, there's only about, I don't know, maybe about a dozen shows in the history of television that have done 300 episodes or more, and they're still going. I mean, I don't know when that's going to stop. So, you know, when you get, like, I mean, Joe says, I'll be the guy that turns the lights off on this show when it's over. Like, I'm not going anywhere, because he knows, he's been around long enough to know, when you get on a hit show, you ride that horse until it's dead. You don't leave. It's a double-edged sword, you know, especially sitcom stuff. You know, you get so identified with those characters, sometimes it's hard to break free from that. I mean, the cast of Gilligan's Island can tell you that, and I mean, none of them ever did much at all because they were so typecast as those people, you know.
Yeah.
Beverly Hillbillies too, you know, it just happens sometimes, unfortunately, because they're all really good actors.
You know, we're out of time. I would love to bring it back and talk some more. This is, you know, one of those things that's so interesting. And I think that, you know, we talked about the importance of creativity and how to, you know, not to stifle your own creativity. You got to go with the flow. You know, right before we go, any parting words of advice to our listeners let me just end that question there. Any parting words of advice to our listeners?
Well, I guess my only advice would be to writers, because that's kind of the thing that I know most, is write what you think is funny, or what you think is dramatic, or what you think is scary. Don't ever try to write what you think other people will think is scary or funny or dramatic, because that's where you get into trouble, because you don't know. Like we talked about that earlier. We never know what an audience is going to respond to. And nobody knew Friends was going to be that big of a hit. Seinfeld, the first season, the ratings were so-so. It was the second season when it started to take off. You just don't know what fans are going to, or audiences are going to respond to. So you just have to satisfy yourself as an artist. You have to write what you think is good. And if that translates to an audience, then you have success. It might not, but at least you did it. You did it to satisfy yourself, you know? And my only other thing is don't ever do it with the purpose of, like, I'm going to be rich and famous. Because I'm certainly not rich or famous by doing this, but I have a lot of fun, and I enjoy doing it very much. And that's the key to life. I think if you can have fun and enjoy doing what you do for a living, then you're not really working, you know?
Yeah, I love it. We're going to end on that. Danny Ram, thank you so much for taking time to hang out with us. Appreciate you very much, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Thank you, Bert. I had a great time. We'll do it again sometime soon.
All right. Good stuff there from writer-producer Danny Ram. This guy, writer-producer for Criminal Minds, Hollywood Weapons, Booger, Bottom USA. Lot of great information there. For you writers, for you creative people, do it for yourself. If it's something that you would watch, if it's something that you would listen to, then you might be successful with it. As always, my friends, let's share this episode with everybody you know. And as always, remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.